Welcome to the Writer Dojo with your host, Steve Diamond.
There can be only one.
And Larry Correa.
From the dawn of time we came, moving silently down through the centuries, living many secret lives, struggling to reach the time of the gathering, when the few who remain will battle to the last. No one has ever known we were among you until now.
Today's episode, your job is to entertain.
Dun, dun, dun.
Want to live forever? 1980s trip down memory lane there.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Writer Dojo. Glad to have you all back with us. Thank you for your patience with us. Last week we missed because my brain doesn't work right now.
Oh, man. It was both of us, actually, because you actually did have some time. Like, you had like...
I had a day.
You literally had like 4 hours your entire week that weren't booked. And so Steve called me and is like, hey, I can get together with you like, what was it, like Saturday from 3 to 7 or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And it was like, oh, I was already doing something else. And I was like, oh, dude, I just can't, man. I'm too fried.
No. And so for people to understand what's been going on with me lately, with you, it's Graveyard of Demons all day, every day.
Oh, yeah. I am almost done with that. I'm working on the finale and editing of Graveyard of Demons.
Yeah. So for me, it's been... all government pricing all day, every day, into the nights and the weekends.
It kind of sucks the ability to be a writer right out of you.
Well, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, I'm just too tired to do anything. We had a bid in Saudi Arabia.
Ooh.
And so...
But that's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're, you know, 10 hours ahead of us. Well, at the time, they were 10 hours ahead of us. So I was matching my schedule to Saudi Arabia and Arizona and Florida. And I'm like, but when do I sleep? They're like, you don't get to do that, kid. So, I mean, job security, I guess, but lame. So, yeah, I don't even have the energy to like watch TV.
Yeah. Steve's really good at his day job, guys. And because of that, he's in demand. Which is an unfortunate side effect of being really good at what he does, but also for trying to still make that jump to full-time writer, it is a butt kicker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hosting a writing podcast on the side.
Yeah. Yeah. So literally since the last time we met to record, I basically did 12s and had no days off.
Yeah. That'll do it.
Until just this last Sunday was my first day off.
Yeah, and me, I'm up against a hard deadline for Graveyard of Demons. My problem is on that one, the challenge there is it's the last book of the series.
Yep.
And it's a big epic series. There is a lot of stuff to wrap up. There's a lot of things that like, wow, I'd like to explain what happens to this guy. It's a big finale. It's going to be bigger than the other books. I'm actually kind of at that jagged edge of...
Well, if this were any other book, your word count would basically be right there right now.
Oh yeah, I'd be done. Yeah, I'd be. Yeah. It would be done right now. Problem is, there's so much stuff. I'm like, how much stuff do I want to finish off for this big epic series? I mean, I don't need to say what happens to every single person, obviously, but I kind of want to. And I mean, so I'm at the jagged edge of this being split into two books or one tight one. I don't know. It's gonna be interesting. But I'm down to the last couple months of this project, and it's kind of my magnum opus fantasy series. So that's been kind of consuming my life and kicking my butt.
Yeah. Now, during all of this, this isn't to say that our heads were buried in the sand and we weren't seeing what was out there. You probably saw that Larry and I, mainly Larry, I just jumped on Twitter just to be like, I don't even understand this guy. But there was a certain individual.
Well, to lay the groundwork, I believe it was about a month ago, we did an episode where we did some bad Twitter writing advice. As you guys know, if you follow the show, I like to do bad Twitter writing advice voice because we know what these people sound like. And they all sound the same. And it's always pretentious bullcrap from people who don't know what they're talking about. And well, this guy, a month later, came back and was very upset that I had questioned his brilliance. And it turned into him giving out his rules of writing advice to thousands of people who were baffled and confused, and it got really weird and wacky. And like, and after 2 days of this guy going off, I felt like bad for him and blocked him and for self-defense, like not my defense, for his.
Yeah.
Like I got to the point where I had crossed the line from, I've used up all the comedy available, to where I'm now, I feel sad.
Yeah.
You're for just picking on this dude.
Yeah. I mean, he was just a pinata that was hanging on by a thread at that point.
It was bad. Yeah. But there was some really awful writing advice in there. And one of the ones stood out to me and Steve, and I'm not even going to do bad Twitter writing advice today, because we want to just tackle the subject. Because it is a really important one for writers to understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean the whole first thing that drew our attention was, if you write a book solely to entertain, it's a failure and you have failed. And we were like, what?
Yeah,
because why are you being dumb?
There's actually, that's not just wrong. There's like layers to the wrongness. Mm-hmm. And he expounded on the wrongness and like doubled down on the wrongness, and it got weirder and weirder. And so my take on this, and I quoted Jim Butcher, was Jim's famous quote on this is, never preach harder than you entertain.
Right.
So I want to clarify a few things. Like, I have this rep that I'm like anti-message fiction. I'm not. I'm not anti-message fiction.
No, and we talked about this in one of our episodes.
We've talked about this before. Message fiction isn't inherently bad. There's nothing wrong with having themes. There's nothing wrong with having deeper meaning. There's nothing wrong with any of this stuff. If you want to tackle the big issues of the day, that's great. If you want to comment on some important thing that's important to you, by all means do so.
Well, shoot, we have a friend, Maurice.
Yeah, good dude, good writer.
Who, I remember being on a panel with him.
Brought us out of Indianapolis.
Maurice brought us. I remember being on a panel with him and you know, someone asked him about, like, you know, the messages that he liked to put into his fiction. And he's like, well, look, he's like, I've experienced a lot of injustice in my life and et cetera, et cetera. He's like, and I like to include that in stuff. So you and he were in that same Predator anthology. Mm-hmm. It was the Alien anthology, excuse me.
Okay. And I actually hired him for a Monster Hunter story once,
right,
too.
Yeah. Right. Great dude, great author. And he's like, you know what? If I'm going to write an Alien anthology or an Alien story, he's like, I want it to feel like it's coming from a guy like me. And so he was talking about, like, you know, experimentation that Weyland-Yutani was doing on like African-American type folks and stuff. Right. But his whole thing was, I have to make sure it's entertaining, even though he definitely has a message within it.
Yeah. The thing is, we can do anything, but mm-hmm. we're entertainers first and foremost. Now, there is a whole genre of books that just exist just for the message.
Mm-hmm.
The message, you know,
yeah. Reverb.
You know, Reverb, to quote Critical Drinker there. And that is a thing. But for the most part, what most of us who make a living at this stuff do is, we're entertainers first and foremost. And the issue is when the preaching overcomes the entertainment. So there is no thing there, if you set out to entertain, you have failed. No, because there are types of books and types of movies and types of TV shows and art in general, comic books, whatever, video games, whatever it be, they are just to entertain. There isn't a deeper message, and that's okay. That's fine. You can't tell other artists, this is the only way you're allowed to make art, and if you don't make art according to my criteria, you're a failure.
Yeah.
Because the world of art is too big.
Well, in art, just in its nature, is a subjective construct, right? I mean, that's why there's so many different types and styles and themes and flavors within art. I mean, just from books themselves to you know, to go into an art exhibit, you know, going to the Met, whatever, going to the Louvre out in Paris, right? Like, I remember walking around that, and for example, I remember walking into the room where the Mona Lisa was.
And it's surprisingly small.
It's, first of all, it's freaking tiny.
It's very small.
It's like 11 by 16 or something.
That was my takeaway the first time I saw the Mona Lisa. I was like, huh, that's really little. Well,
and there's all these gajillions of people just pressed in around it, right? And I remember walking in there, seeing it, and going, okay, whatever. And then I turned around, and on the wall opposite of it, going out of that same room, is a painting that's like, I don't know, like
10 feet tall,
10 feet by like 15 feet wide or something stupid. Yeah. Like it's all life size. Yeah. And I remember stopping and just staring at that.
Yeah. It's actually really impressive.
And I don't know if they meant it. I don't know if they meant to do this, if this was part of the game where it's like, hey, look at this tiny thing that's pretty, I guess, cool and impressive. And then you turn around and you're just blown away by this giant piece of art. But there wasn't anybody, crowded around that one. But my wife and I stood and stared at that one for like 10 minutes with our backs to the Mona Lisa, because one of those to us was impressive. The other one wasn't. It's not to say that the Mona Lisa is bad or wrong. No, it's just not my thing.
It's culturally impressive.
Yeah.
It's historically impressive.
Exactly. But
I hadn't even heard of the other guy.
Me neither.
My wife had. She's got an art history degree.
Yeah. But that, like, that's the point here, is there's so many different ways to look at art that to put a box around it and say, you can only do this, or thou shalt only do that. Well, it defeats the purpose of art to begin with.
Well, anytime you say you, we've talked about this on the show a million times, but anytime we say, this is a rule, you must do this or you're a failure. I mean, honestly, on this show, the only time we've ever said that is make sure you pay your taxes. And it's not that you're a failure or you're a bad person. It's just they'll put you in jail. And even then, so that's just a suggestion. But
yeah,
it's all just suggestions. And he had another one. It was like, if you don't have comedy in a book, then, because real life has comedy. If you don't have comedy in a book, if you don't have a few moments of humor in a book, it's a failure. And I was like, Cormac McCarthy. I was like, no one has ever read Blood Meridian. And I was like, haha, that's a laugh.
Well, yeah. I mean, No Country for Old Men is not known for its humor.
You know, these books are known for like their scalping massacres.
The Road?
Oh, yeah. It's bleak and apocalyptic death.
Well, I mean, gosh, I mean,
no one would describe any of those books as a failure. They might not be your thing. I mean, I like punctuation, personally.
I do, too. But, dude, I love No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, I love the freaking movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's great.
See, and that's the thing.
I actually like The Road.
Yeah, I couldn't get into that one. But the thing is, so there's super successful authors who violate every single rule that you throw out there. And our example on that, too, is like Dan Simmons gets away with it, but you're not Dan Simmons. So a lot of these things are suggestions that you need to work up to have the skill set necessary to pull it off and make it awesome. Which was another thing that issue that we ran in here. And so this guy, of course, had a How to Be a Writer book.
Of course he did.
Because that's such a cliche.
So how to be a...
when you find a dude who has like no books, no sales, like they've written 3 or 4 books and they have like 60 reviews total.
Across all four books.
And like the new books have no reviews. And they've sold... And there's Amazon sales ranking somewhere in the millions and millions.
Yeah, and they like start 4 million or something like that.
And they start establishing their expertise. It's like, dude, guys, this is a skill like any other skill. This is a job like any other job. And there is nothing wrong with offering advice. There is nothing wrong with having an opinion. But by golly, it's the same thing Tony Weisskopf told me when I was first going on panels at conventions. Know where your place is in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And the advice that you're dispensing as being like this indispensable, I'm so sure advice might be objectively terrible. And so this guy got all butthurt and he's like, well, you're just comparing your stuff to me, trying to lord it over me. And it's like, no, actually, I'm just trying to establish for the audience street cred is what it is. Which was the best part of it is he came back and he says, well, I'll bet you, and he had some elaborate bet he wanted to make that
in 9 years, I'm going to blah, 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 blah.
Because like Monster Hunter had been on Amazon for 9 years.
The second edition.
Yeah. And so it had like 9,000 reviews.
Yeah. Something like that.
8,000 something reviews, close to 9,000 reviews. And he's like, well, I'll bet you that I'll have 10 times, my book of such and such will have 10 times as many reviews in 9 years. To put that in perspective, Dune, which has been out since 1965 and has a billion-dollar movie franchise and is like one of the most pivotal works of science fiction ever, Dune has 90,000 reviews.
Yeah,
It's like, dude, just calm down. Actually, I felt a lot better because I started looking, it was like Lord of the Rings, like, you know, Return of the King has 20,000 reviews, you know, Fellowship of the Ring has 20,000. I actually feel pretty good about how many reviews I have.
Right?
after looking at that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. You know, I look at Servants. It has about 1,000 reviews. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I'll take it.
All good.
When Fellowship of the Ring has 20,000, and that little book of ours has 1,000, and it's been out for a couple years.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah, serious.
You know, so it's not about establishing whether you're good or bad or right or wrong. It's just establishing street cred. How much actual business knowledge have you done? I mean, how much business have you conducted as a writer?
Well, and if you are going to be giving out, and I believe the title of his book was something like The Seven-Figure Author or something like that. And I'm like, look, if you're telling me how to raise $7 million, or not seven, like over $1 million, then I better see on your books that it is done similar, right? You know, it was like when we were in college, dude. Like, the best teachers I had in college were the ones that had actually done this stuff in real life.
Exactly. Like, when I was getting my accounting degree, the best professors by far were dudes who had gone out and done business and had a business career and who were now teaching.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to.
Yeah. One of my favorite teachers that I had at BYU was for international business, and he was this expat who'd been the CEO of AT&T Japan. I'm like,
dude,
I'm
knows
like, okay,
stuff.
This guy knows everything. And I loved that teacher, right?
The worst professors were the ones who went to college and then went to more college and then went to more college and now they teach college.
Yeah. And then they were teaching theoretical economics.
Yeah. And it's like, they've not actually done anything ever at any point for get an accounting degree. I mean, at least economics is academic and a lot of it is theoretical or statistical modeling or that kind of thing. Accounting is like rubber hits the road, nuts and bolts business, right? And so I had the guys who'd never been in business telling us how to do stuff would just kill me now. It's so awful. And then you get the dudes who like done it for 30 years. Now they're just doing it because they think it's fun. Those guys were the best. There's a parallel to be drawn here with creative writing instructors,
no,
too.
No, that is it exactly, right? Like, you know, okay, Brandon, right? Brandon is...
been there, done that kind of guy.
Well, and he's been teaching this stuff. And so when he's in a class and he's teaching you the manner in which he conducts himself and the way he goes about his craft, that resonates with people because he has, at this point... like $80 million worth of Kickstarters to back up his process.
Yeah.
But if, I don't even remember this dude's name, if he runs a Kickstarter, you know how much money?
I don't want to use his name because I don't want to like single the dork out.
But I mean, why would I listen to a guy who has 60 total? Brandon has made more millions than this guy has reviews.
Ouch.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, when you put it in perspective like that, it's pathetic.
Well, the guy was a liar, too, because he was like saying, I've sold hundreds of, or he was talking about how he was making mid-six figures in book sales. Mm-hmm. I was like,
no, you're not.
Because if he's like, I don't use Amazon. That's why I don't have any reviews on Amazon. Okay, so first off, Amazon, we just check it because it's the world's largest retailer of books. And if you are selling, like, we know guys who are direct. We know guys who have a business by selling directly to their fans.
But guess what? They still have tons of reviews on Amazon.
And they still have tons of reviews on Goodreads, which isn't connected to sales of a sales point of any one entity.
Well, and I thought about this, too. I thought about the corporate sales aspect. Remember how we had to do all that corporate training when we worked at our military-industrial complex
endless
job?
Endless amounts.
And it was all of that. It was that, those like books that are only for business people, but they're all super poorly written.
I'm a Six Sigma green belt.
That's right. I mean, all that stuff, you know,
I really am. I don't even remember what.
You know, the Deception of Peace or whatever the stupid books were called, right?
Oh, it was so bad.
And you know, and those businesses make their money by doing corporate training and selling you like 35 million gajillion copies of the book that no one actually reads because they're terrible.
Yeah, I remember the last one we had to do. Me and you just mocked it the whole time because of how bad the book was.
Oh, it was so bad. Well, and there's factual incorrectness
within
it.
We were like editor hat on during the meetings,
so
like
bad.
Marking up the books.
We never did another book after that.
I know. We had like two novelists in corporate training. Yeah. Were given these, issued these corporate hardcovers. That were like,
this book is stupid. But even then, those same books on Amazon still have thousands of reviews.
Yeah.
This didn't.
Yeah.
So the guy was a liar.
Guy's a liar. Yeah. I mean, if you are selling hundreds of thousands of copies or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of copies. So we did the math. I'm accounting. I do the math. He was talking about he's moving 20 or 30,000 copies a year.
No, he wasn't. No.
Because if you're moving 20 or 1,000 copies a year as a private writer, you know, not using Amazon, you're going to have some form of attention or some people are going to talk about those books.
Yeah.
Period.
And this guy, no one knew who he was.
Yeah. Exactly. Except for conning people on Facebook or Twitter. So guys, when you're getting this writing advice out there, be buyer beware. Okay, watch out, guys. Just a lot of people are full of crap.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about this whole idea of entertainment, entertaining your audience. We'll be right back.
What part of the Second Amendment don't you understand? That's the question posed by award-winning New York Times bestselling author and professional firearms instructor Larry Kuria. Me. Bringing with him the practical experience that comes from having owned a high-end gun store, and as a competitive shooter and self-defense trainer, Kuria blasts apart the emotion-laden, logic-free rhetoric of the gun control fanatics who turn every mass shooting into a crazed call for violating your rights, abusing the Constitution, and doing absolutely nothing to really fight crime. In his essential new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment, Kuria reveals why gun-free zones are more dangerous for law-abiding citizens, how the Second Amendment does indeed include your right to own an AR-15, and why that's not an outdated concept, why red flag laws don't work and can be easily abused and ignore a much more commonsensical approach to keeping guns out of the wrong hands, the insanity of criminal justice reform, the freeze dangerous criminals and gun reform that penalizes your right to self-defense. How can we return to a society that has a safe and healthy relationship with guns, as we had for most of our history? Believe me, I've heard every argument relating to gun control possible. I can show you how to defend your rights. Urgent, informed, and vitally important information for whoever owns a gun, or is thinking about owning a gun, or who cares about the preservation of our constitutional rights, In Defense of the Second Amendment is a landmark book of enduring importance.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Okay. All right, Larry, so when it comes to entertainment, I want to talk about like expectations and managing expectations about when you're building up your story, you're writing your book, your stories, and you're putting them out there. There's really only, you can't let your expectations get too high.
It's what you got to have your goal when you're going in.
Right.
And it's a lot of it depends on your audience and your genre. So like if I am writing, like Son of the Black Sword is, it either gets lumped in with epic fantasy or sword and...
kind of sword and sorcery.
Yeah. So it's going to be one of those two genres is really where it's going to belong. Mm-hmm. Now, there's certain things that can hit in that and people are going to expect, certain things I'm not. But you think about it, I talk about slavery and racism and genocide and caste systems.
Yeah.
And religion and the nature of government and everybody's cruel and bad things happen.
Nanotechnology.
The good guy at the opening of the book, the good guy, the hero, kicks a slave for not bringing him food fast enough.
Yeah.
Okay. He's the hero of the story. So yeah, you can tackle.
That's actually very sword and sorcery.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a reviewer the other day said it's not, it's definitely not a Conan clone or a Cone clone or Clonan.
A Clonan.
He said he's not a Clonan. But this is definitely the kind of character that would exist in the Conan universe, you know? And so, yeah, Ashok Vidala, that's how he is. And so, yeah, we tackle all this kind of stuff and all these issues. But first and foremost, this is a story about a magical law enforcement agent who, you know, wanders land fighting demons and criminals with a magic sword.
Well, you're writing it. Right. Like, and I know I'm this way when I'm writing. If I'm not having fun and if I'm not entertained by my own story that I'm putting down on paper, boy, I'm in a world of hurt.
Yeah. It's got to be first and foremost, what does my audience want? And then I'm going to provide that product mm-hmm. to the audience. Because once again, a lot of people get offended. We talk about art as a product, but it is a product. Mm-hmm. And we have an audience, and that audience is who pays our bills. The cringiest thing in the universe right now is when you are seeing some upcoming TV show. And it's usually a genre fiction TV show. It's sci-fi, yeah. fantasy, usually produced by Disney because they own yes. everything now, from some big IP. And the showrunner will come on. We talked about this a few episodes ago. And the showrunner will have an interview. And they'd be like, yeah, I got this new Star Wars show. And the most important thing is that we have queer representation. No, it's not.
No, no. Your story is the most important part.
Everybody in the audience who is a normal person, who isn't a political animal, and this is not bagging on anyone political issue. You could sub that for any other representation you want. Mm-hmm. That was just the last one I saw on the news. It was for the Alkalite. And and the minute a showrunner says something like that, 90% of the audience goes, oh gosh, not again. Because I don't care, even if you are super into whatever the subject is, even if you are a political junkie who loves that stuff, and that is like you got rainbow flags all over your profile, good for you, whatever, I don't care. You hear that coming in your entertainment project, and even people who are super into it just go, oh, not again. Because why? Because people want to be entertained. They don't want to be preached at.
Look, I mean, life's hard enough. Okay. The real world news is full of despair and moronic idiocy.
Dude, I am so checked out right now.
Me too.
Like, it's so bad out there.
You know, we all have the vast majority of us have day jobs. And, you know, I was just talking about mine at the top of the episode. Like, it's a grind. So when I sit down to watch something, I don't need to watch something that's telling me about, I don't know, social woes about some weird group that I don't know anything about. Or
a lot of times that stuff is like, it becomes a cop out. Mm-hmm. It becomes a cop out excuse, because then when the thing fails because it was just not good,
then it's the fault of the fans.
It's because the fans hate X, whatever mm-hmm. topic X was, they shoehorned in there. They hate strong women.
You know, well, I mean, that was The Witcher, right? The
Witcher.
What? It's like, no. We just wanted the guy who's The Witcher to be in his own show.
Yeah, it's literally called The Witcher. It's based on a series of books about The Witcher.
Yeah, and you know.
And a video game.
Call me crazy.
Starring The Witcher.
I'd really like it to be accurate to source material, or at least show that it's honoring the source material.
Yeah, I would take.
Why he got fired.
I would take honoring, because he got fired for it. And it was like, it's like he didn't want to do enough sex scenes. It's like, you hate strong women. Well, that, and I also hate bad writing and dumb special effects and horribly choreographed action sequences. Oh
my gosh, I couldn't even finish season three.
It
was so bad.
I didn't start season three. I got halfway through season two.
And season two is probably the high point.
Yeah, and actually I got bored. Dude, I have The Witcher role-playing game, and I've read the book. Yeah, you have it too?
Yeah, it's
over here. We bought it at Gen Con.
Yeah, we bought it at Gen Con.
Yeah, the year it came out. I liked it. I mean, and I played the crap out of the video game.
Yeah, it's a great game.
Witcher 3, great game.
Freaking great
game. Dude, I got really good at Gwent, okay?
Yeah.
I got all the cards.
Yeah.
Right, I won them all.
There's a trophy for that.
Yeah, I know. That's pretty cool. Just saying. And so, I mean, I got the Xbox achievement. And so, the thing is, like I'm a fan. But the show was not for me. The show needs representation for like what? I don't know. It was dumb. And see, that's one of those things where people are putting the preaching ahead of the entertainment. If they had just had The Witcher and then shoehorned in some stuff, no one would have cared. We would have been fine. You want to hit some issues? Hit some issues.
Well, the Witcher stories themselves, especially the first ones, are basically just fairy tales.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the traditional fairy tales retold a little darker. And there are massive issues that the author addresses within those stories, especially issues of racism.
It's a dark world, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Knife ears.
Yeah.
They hate it.
You know, they talk about all this stuff. It's already in there, right? It's like Wheel of Time, right? That was already a feminist project to start with.
I didn't watch that at all.
Well, I mean, the books themselves are very feminist. But this TV show's like, no, we decided it had to be, I guess, more feminist. And it's like, guys, just stick with the story. It already has that stuff built into it.
Yeah. And when we're creating these stories from scratch, if you want to have your story be about that, great. That's what the story's about. I remember an example one time, and I can't remember what, I think it was from, I think it might have been Dean Koontz. A long time ago, Dean Koontz wrote a How to Be a Writer Guide. See, that's what I was talking about, How to Be a Writer Guide. If you're Dean Koontz, you can totally write a How to Be a Writer Guide.
Well, I mean, you know, Dean Koontz, like, there's a reason why probably the most popular book people point at for how to be a writer is Stephen King's.
Yeah, because
that dude has sold a gajillion books.
Because, I mean, I can't stand Stephen King on a personal level, but the dude works and he writes, okay?
The first one I actually read was Terry Brooks.
Well, so this Dean Koontz one, he goes through and he had a story, and I think maybe it was him, or might have been Michael Crichton. But somebody like that. But they had an example of a writer that they knew who kept always picking like whatever his pet topic was. And I want to say it was like prescription drug abuse.
Sure.
And he would always shoehorn this into a book. So he'd have a book that was about something entirely different.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden there'd be the rant. Yeah.
Body snatchers from Mars. But here's a prescription rant.
That, because too much people abuse oxycodone or whatever it was. But whatever it was of the day, but it was always shoehorned in there. And finally, Dean Koontz or Michael Crichton, whoever it was, I'm totally butchering this. Whoever's actually read this book will be like, oh, it's so-and-so, and I'm probably totally wrong. But they finally, the famous author was like, dude, that's what clearly the book you want to write. Go write that freaking book.
Yeah, get it out of your system.
Get it out of your system. Quit shoehorning this other unrelated topic that you're passionate about into these other books. Because it doesn't fit. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel natural. It feels like you're cramming it in. And audiences hate that. Books, movies, video games. It's like when you're playing a video game. Oh my gosh.
Oh, it's when you're playing, it's like the video game that they shove like a very specific, like
modern political issue into.
Oh my gosh.
I was thinking of Dragon Age. Dragon Age 2.
Yeah.
So I'm playing video games. Maybe it was Dragon Age 3. I don't know. It was one of those.
That'd have been 2.
And I was playing, oh, so bad.
Because one was good.
Yeah, one was good. So I'm playing this video game. I'm fighting monsters. I'm fighting dragons. I'm like a magical warrior, and I have my team of wizards and whatnot. And then out of nowhere, I'd be having a conversation with some like other person, and it'd be like, here's a political issue from the year 2012, 2013, or whatever year this game was. And it would just shove it right in your face. And it's like, dude, this has nothing to do with this world, with this game. I mean, we're being invaded by extra dimensional demon dragons, and your concern is incorrect pronouns. I don't know. Dude.
No, that's legit though.
Yeah. Because right now, I mean, yeah. there's a demon dragon coming to eat us.
Well, and here you want to know what really bothers me about that. It was like the whole idea of, we kind of touched on this in the whole swearing episode as well. It's that people seem to think, a lot of authors seem to think, that whatever real world issue is going on right now, or the way something is said in a real world, in our world, is definitely how it would be in this totally made up world. I'm like, our political issues today are a result of thousands of years of buildup.
And they won't even be our political issues in a month.
They won't. So why would a secondary world end up with the same political issues as us? It's like, this is stupid, guys.
It's stupid. That's why I have Ashok Vidal kicking a slave. And he's the hero. Because it's got to be organic for the world that exists in. And a lot of this stuff feels trite and dated, because if you go back to 2010 even, and you look at the hot button political issue of the day.
Well, and especially in sci-fi. Especially in sci-fi.
It's so blatant in sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's painful. Guys, it's painful. But the thing is, you can still have these issues in there. It's just got to be organic, and it's got to feel natural to the setting and the universe. I mean, obviously I'm writing urban fantasy. If I want to talk about modern urban, you know, modern issues.
That's totally fine.
It's urban fantasy.
That's totally fine.
It's a real thing. It actually exists.
Yeah. But I mean, the political issues and the socioeconomic issues in, say, servants of war really don't have anything to do with our world.
I mean, everybody knows I'm a right-wing gun nut.
Yeah.
Would it make sense for me to shove, you know, the, you know, rah, rah. I love the Second Amendment. You guys, I mean, I've wrote a book about how much I love the Second Amendment. I love the Second Amendment. I love the right to self-defense. In Kolakovia, would it make sense for me to suddenly shove the right for the people to keep and bear arms as being a big thing in Kolakovia? The czardom that's under, like, the brutal control of the secret police with absolute control over everything.
No, I mean, if people had guns, they'd be rich.
First off, they're too poor. Most of them are too poor.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the fact that most of the soldiers, they have a shovel.
Yeah, even the army has like one gun for every three dudes. I mean, they stand in awe of the Almatians having a gun per soldier. I mean, that's crazy. But like,
Their circumstances have improved a little bit in book two.
If I did that though, I mean, but like out in the middle of nowhere, they got a little shotgun to hunt, you know?
Yeah.
But that was normal. But like, if I was to shove that in there as a thing, it would,
it doesn't make feel any natural.
Mm-hmm. Now I introduce guns into Son of the Black Sword, but what are they? They're first off, they're illegal. They're controlled, but they're also a tool of rebellion that makes a castless, a lowly, weak, physically weak, malnourished castless, the equal in battle of a warrior who's trained his whole life.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's our world historical precedent.
Yeah, and I introduce firearms as this series goes on, but it's not rah-rah America, F yeah, like I am in real life, because that wouldn't make a lick of sense. In this world, though, it's a tool of rebellion for the weak to stand up to the strong. So I do shove my themes in there.
Well, I mean,
but in a way that makes perfect sense for the world.
Take the new Godzilla movie, for example.
Haven't seen it yet, but I heard it's awesome.
It's freaking dope.
I heard it's rad.
It takes place post World War II, right? Right after the bombs were dropped. And in that movie, again, made by Japan, right? Made in Japan. You would think that if they wanted to shove the political message of America's bad, they'd drop bombs on us. Like, as the audience, you go, oh, okay, I can understand why these people would say
that. Might be a sore spot.
However, they don't. And it's basically, it's the tale. It's a tale of redemption, basically, for a kamikaze pilot.
Oh.
And I'm not going to spoil it for you, but the way it ends, you're like, I buy it. But if it had ended a slightly different way, you still would have said, I buy it. That's good storytelling. Their job, they wanted to entertain first. Their job is, it's like, here's freaking Godzilla killing everything.
And it's
because he's awesome.
Huge hit.
Yeah. Massive hit.
Made way more money than it cost.
Dude, it cost him $15 million to make.
Which in America, that's like the donut budget.
Yeah. I mean, there's B movies that have a higher budget than that here. They entertained first.
Seth Rogen's marijuana budget.
At least. I mean, that's like half of King's cocaine budget from the 80s.
So, he paid for one of Pablo Escobar's hippos.
Several of them, I bet. You know, now here's the last thing that I think I want us to talk about before we end our episode here about your job is to entertain. One of the things that he was saying, that this guy on Twitter was saying, was that it's like, look, your fiction, the job of it is to, you know, point out issues and to help people get through stuff.
To serve a higher
purpose. Serve a higher purpose. It's like, well, look, I'm sorry, but expectations, okay? I can't have the expectation, Larry, that when I write something, that it is going to change someone's life. I can't have that expectation.
No.
Will my fiction do that? I don't know.
Maybe.
If it does, if it changes the life of one person, cool, man. I'll feel awesome about that.
One time
I was in the office with you when you got this email. I know what you're going to say.
Oh, I know. I don't share. I mean, I've changed people's lives, but
I know.
I don't share those stories for a reason. Right. They're not mine.
They're personal.
So one time I was on a panel at a con and it was four writers, me, Jim Butcher, Kevin J. Anderson, and another writer who will remain unnamed, and you'll see why. So somebody in the audience asked us the question and said, have you as a writer ever, you know, changed someone's life? You know, this whole serve and hire purpose thing. And I went to Kevin first, and he had a very classy answer. And he says, yeah, sure. I've heard that from people. Like, people have emailed me or sent me letters and told me that, yeah, whatever. He's like, but you know, those aren't my stories. I just, my job is to just entertain people. And sometimes I'm in the right place at the right time, or my book's in the right place at the right time. Comes to me, I have a similar answer, because I'm like, yeah, I've heard that from people. I've helped some people through some dark times. I'm like, my book was just like the one that they found when they were in a bad place. I know the story you're thinking of.
Yep.
It was a big deal for this guy. And I was the book that was in the right place at the right time for somebody and make a difference. But you know what? That ain't my story. That's his. Yeah. I was just a dude. And I set out to entertain. Jim Butcher, super classy answer. Jim's a classy guy.
Same thing.
Yeah. Same dang thing. We all said the same dang thing.
Until that guy.
This last guy. Goes to this last guy. He went off on this like 10-minute story, self-aggrandizing bull crap about how great and brilliant he was and how he saved this young man's life who was, he was so despondent and so depressed and at the edge of suicide. And then until he read this guy's brilliant book that changed his life and turned everything around and blah, blah, blah. And here's the thing, that even if the story is true, which knowing this guy, I give it a 50-50, or at least it's exaggerated, that ain't you. You were just a dude that wrote that book, and it could have been somebody else, and it could have been a different book, could have been a different person. And I saw Kevin and Jim said, you know what, that to me is the attitude as an author you should have. It's the healthy attitude. It's like, dude, I'm just here to make people happy.
Oh yeah, dude. I mean, I remember at a signing,
I saved his life.
No, you and I were at a signing once, and this guy came up to me and said some stuff that super humbled me, because he was like, hey, thank you, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to say what he said, but like that. Yeah. I mean, that feeling, I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah.
Like I started like tearing up and stuff. I'm like, geez, dude. And, but one, what kind of idiot am I, if I'm going out there and that's my goal?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, how selfish is that?
The people who set, it's like any other form of charity or service. The people who set out to do like a self-aggrandizing, it's about me thing.
It loses all value.
It loses its value. It's like that old quote about, you know, mandated charity. It's like charity without loving, giving without, gratitude or receiving without gratitude. It, really what it comes down to is sometimes we can help people. Sometimes we can't, and you don't really know, and you do the best you can. That's it.
That's it.
But if you set out to be like, it's like people who buck for leadership in any organization are usually the worst people in that organization.
Yeah.
Writers who set out to be change the world, they're usually the most annoying dorks in the universe.
Yeah.
And they ain't changing crap.
No.
They're just annoying us.
Yeah. So guys, I hope what the point here that you're seeing is, look, again, your job is to entertain first and foremost. And you can do that in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
But
if you want to save lives, become a doctor, become a paramedic.
Oh, I was going to say, become a first responder.
Become a nurse.
Yeah.
You know,
go be a cop. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
an author who saved people's lives, Mike Cooperie,
literally
defusing bombs,
literally.
Okay. That's saving lives, guys. Our job is to entertain.
Yeah. I mean,
our job is to make people happy.
Yeah. I mean, we know a guy, Kelly Grayson, right?
Oh, like, dude, Kelly saves all
paramedic.
Kelly's a writer. Yeah. Kelly, like paramedic of the year. This dude has saved some lives, man.
Yeah. Like, but and he good will take, too. And he will take some of those experiences he had as in real world and input some of that emotion and experience and knowledge into his books. But that's not the goal of the stories. His stories are to entertain. And absolutely, he'll be the first to tell you that. So guys, look, entertain. The better you entertain, I mean, one, the happier you're going to be as an author. Because if all you're doing is just shoving a political message down someone's throat, your audience ain't having fun. And honestly, you're probably not having that much fun either writing that story.
Most of these people I know who are like that are the most freaking miserable sucks I've
I know they're right?
Like sourpusses of misery.
Oh my gosh, they're just little black holes of social despair.
Despair and sadness.
All right, guys.
Restraining orders.
I know who you're talking about.
we try not to name names.
Oh boy. Yeah, oh. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Ouch.
All right, guys. That's all the time we have for you today. So, guys, remember, here's your assignment. You know how sometimes we give assignments out, yeah. You know? Here's what your assignment is, guys. Entertain. That's it. This is the Writer Dojo. We'll see you on the next one.
Writer Dojo is Steve Diamond and Larry Correa. Produced by Jack Wilder and Bear and Hare Studios. Theme song, Word Mercenaries by Craig Nybo. New episodes come out every Wednesday wherever you stream your content. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can help support us by going to anchor.fm/writerdojo, by leaving a 5-star rating and review, and by helping to spread the word. To advertise on the Writer Dojo, email ads@writerdojo.com. All questions and comments can be emailed to questions@writerdojo.com.
Now, I saved his life.